Welcome to the Profitable Steward Podcast with Jared Sorensen. In this series, we'll learn and explore regenerative agriculture principles. Through practices that improve soil health, animal health, and good stewardship, we are working to help you increase your productivity and profitability. Join us in learning from successful farm and ranch experts who share stories of growth from their fields to help your fields grow strong. Here is your host, Jared Sorensen.
Welcome, everybody, to the Profitable Steward Podcast. It's a privilege to be here with some wonderful guests, some fellow ranchers from our area. We have on with us today William DeMille, Gary Wines, Marlo Dahl, and Cade Davis. And my name is Jared Sorensen, and I'll be hosting this. We're going to be talking about something a little bit different today. Normally, we talk about regenerative agriculture practices, and I get a lot of questions with the people that I work with and consult with about farm subsidies. And it seems like that is the majority of the people that are in agriculture, I would safely say, partake in farm subsidies. And so we wanted to share a bit of a different view on that from individuals who are not currently partaking of those subsidies and still managing viable businesses, maybe to compare and contrast a little bit from what we hear from nearly everybody else in the industry. So a little background on farm subsidies in an article written, and I'll put this link in the show notes, but it's quoting the economist Milton Friedman, and his quote is, "Nothing is so permanent as a temporary government program." So we can all see that, right? Nothing is so permanent as a temporary government program. Farm subsidies were started during the Great Depression, perhaps with a legitimate need. Farmers and ranchers who were struggling. And the problem was, as quoted in this article, the Depression went away, the subsidies didn't, and they've continued to increase over the years. We've seen that not only has subsidies increased, but our national debt has increased as well. And so my overarching thesis is that at some point those will go away. And what will happen to the family farm and ranch when that happens? How many of us have a viable business if we pull that away from us? And so while it can be a tool, oftentimes I believe it's a crutch and it props up businesses that maybe shouldn't be in business. And that's harsh to say, but if it's a free market economy, they wouldn't be. So the farm bill is the primary source for farm subsidies. Interestingly enough, there's only a small piece of that pie of the billions of dollars in the farm bill that goes back to farmers. Most of it is nutrition, the SNAP program, food stamps, basically. And so somewhere in around the order, I think currently about $40 billion a year goes back to farmers and ranchers in some type of a subsidy payment. And you can double check the math. I couldn't nail down an exact number, probably because nobody knows what it is, but it's a lot of money. So as we jump in here, that's a little context for what the discussion is going to be. And this will just be kind of an open forum discussion. And we're going to introduce our guests here first. So William DeMille, you want to go ahead and tell us where you're from and a little bit about your background in agriculture?
So I live in Clover Valley, Nevada. And I've been involved in agriculture all my life. I grew up in southern Utah. We had a sheep herd. We raised alfalfa. And we had orchard fruits, apricots, and peaches mostly that we would sell. And then when I became an adult, I moved to Missouri. I was in Missouri in the corn and soybean fields for about 20 years. And through this whole time, I was really involved in gardening and greenhouses. Then when I left Missouri, I started doing education. And so I started teaching people about gardening and greenhouses and all that kind of thing. And so I've been doing that for 15 to 18 years. And so anyway, that's pretty much me.
Very good. Thanks, William. Gary Wines is a neighbor from Ruby Valley. Go ahead and tell us a little bit about your operation and your family history there on the ranch that you currently own and manage.
Well, we first got ownership of part of this place in the early 1870s, and so someone in our family's been here the whole time and kind of blocked up property from then. I was gone for a number of years, but I moved back and I think it was 1989 and started kind of taking over the operation in the early 90s, say 92, 93, from my parents. And there's me and my wife, and my two kids are here now. And I'm kind of stepping back a little bit and letting the kids start making decisions and starting to take over a little bit at a time. Sometimes it seems like a little more than I would like, but that's a hard step to take. But anyway, we run cows, approximately 500 head, which I'll add real quick that my dad always told me, don't think this place can never run more than 350 head. And through changes we've made, we're now easily running 500. And at this point in time, we're a bit understocked.
Yeah, that's neat to see. And so you would be fourth generation?
Fourth, yeah.
Cool. And the kids are raising the fifth generation.
Yeah.
Yeah, very good. Well, welcome, Gary. Glad to have you part of this discussion. Marlo Dahl.
Here I am. Yeah, so we are also in Ruby Valley. We have two ranches. We have TI ranches is one of them, Moylan, and one here in Ruby Valley. But that's the, I guess that's the current era. But my own family, I guess I'd be, as far as the Dahl line, I'd probably be fifth generation in ag. Family started out in South Jordan, Utah, moved to Nevada. I was raised on a ranch there in Star Valley. But that's just my side. The Sorensen side, I married a Jones who's tied back to the Sorensens too through marriage. But on the Jones side, they started in, well, it started in England in agriculture, but in the United States, it goes just to Cedar City. And my father-in-law is a third generation agriculture, so I guess that'd make me fourth and fifth and sixth. Anyway, there's a lot of generations of ag there. And yeah, right now we're, me and my family of six kids, we're probably in that little transition area where Gary's explaining that we're starting to take over more of the decision-making portions of it, I guess. And Ken is my father-in-law, who's still actively involved, and we work together. He's 84 years old. And that's, I guess, that our youngest is three, our oldest is going to be 20. And that's the next generation.
Perfect. Yeah, appreciate that. So, okay, Kate Davis.
Yeah, so Kate Davis, I too am in Nevada, out by Ely, Nevada. I've been in ag essentially all my life, but I'm a first generation ag person. You know, my dad was in the ag industry, but didn't own a farm or ranch. As a kid, that's all I ever wanted to do. And so as soon as I could start working, that's where I went and worked. It was just for the local farmers around me in up in Idaho. And then anyways, gravitated towards the ranch life very young, and started cowboying local or the grazing associations and stuff as a kid, and then just kind of moved on from there. And anyhow, long story short, I've been in kind of management of some cow-calf operations about 15 years now, different places. Currently, I am employed by a larger corporation, which I can't say that I represent, so we won't share their name, just to make sure that we don't get in any trouble there. But they do not take subsidies. And anyways, yeah. So I have a we're raising a family out here. It's a wonderful life. We love the cow calf operation. Like I say, it's been a wonderful way to raise kids, and we have a definite appreciation for freedom and everything that kind of comes along not only with this life, but with where we live in this nation. So I'm grateful to be a part of this call here.
Yeah, I appreciate you having you on here, Cade, and what you contribute. Cade's a constitutionalist. He's read the founding documents. He has a really good understanding of of how this nation was founded based on the principles of the founding fathers. And so not only does he come from an agriculture background, but also invited him on for that purpose as well. I come to this without a list of questions and just really wanting to open it up for discussion here. But there will be, you know, we'll kick this thing off with some questions. So we kind of know a little bit about the background of farm subsidies, you know, it started in the 1930s and has ramped up. And there's been some argument against subsidies, but the challenge is there's lobbyists who are proponents and work for larger corporations, and even for some of the agricultural organizations, NCBA, Cattlemen's Association, Farm Bureau, whose members, you know, pay them to go and lobby for farm subsidies. So by no means are we saying that we just cut this thing off tomorrow. But perhaps if we're going to have a sustainable, viable business, we need to look at ways that we can wean ourselves off of this. So I guess just along those lines, Gary, we'll maybe start with you and just kind of get your opinion overall on partaking in subsidies. Is it good, bad, or different?
I am just totally against subsidies. The only thing I would maybe is maybe some young people wanting to get started and don't have a place to go. Maybe I can see a little help there. But if you got a family ranch that has been in the for who knows how many years, and they still can't make a living without government subsidies, which many of them claim they can't, then in my opinion, they need to take a hard look at how they're operating. Everybody's chasing more and more and more. And by doing that, I think they're just shooting themselves in the foot. They want the bigger cow because they think they want they got to have the heavier calf. So they feed more hay, they feed more this, they feed more that. I don't understand. And I've had discussions with people and we don't seem to understand each other, I guess.
Yeah. And so from your standpoint, Gary, you're saying that you need to have a viable economic model, independent of subsidies. And it's a lot more than just not applying for the programs or whatever. You need to make sure that it is economically viable. Doing some of the things like cow size and improving grazing and improving your carrying capacity.
Right.
Yeah.
If it's not working, then okay, fine. You need to make a change. What other business can just say, well, you know, I'm not making a living here, so can you send me some money? Can Joe taxpayer send me some money to keep my little store going or whatever they happen to be doing, or my construction operation, whatever the case may be? That's not the way it works. But agriculture, they all got their hand out. I shouldn't say all, but.
Yeah, definitely a majority. Marlo, I know you studied economics. What are your thoughts, both from an economic basis as well as an individual ranch owner who's just struggling to make it?
Yeah. Well, maybe I should have done this in my intro, but just as a little bit of context from where I'm coming from and the way our business operates. Ken, my 84-year-old father-in-law, his dad was receiving Social Security checks in the mail after, you know, he reached that age of whatever, 65. After 20 years or something like that, they found all those checks in a drawer. His wife found all those checks in a drawer by the nightstand. He said, I don't want those. I'm going to ship them back. So there's a news article. I should have found it before we did this, but there's a news article that talks about the guy that was trying to give the Social Security checks back to the government. And he made it back. And I said, I don't need them. Give it to somebody that does. Huh. And he had a shop, you know, he had an equipment store, and then he had some farmland. But that was that's, I guess, the mentality of maybe somebody that went through the Great Depression, somebody that had that kind of experience. And he decided that, you know, he wasn't going to take Social Security. He was going to send it back to the government and provide for his family without the help of the government. So that's the mentality, you know, that I guess I'm being taught. Also part of that, before I started working full-time on the ranch, I was working in a bank. I worked in a bank in Southern Utah. And when I was invited to come back here and be with Ken, when Steph and I were invited to come back, I talked to our ag lender down there. Not that I had any ag loans, but just the guy that loaned money for our bank. I said, is this something that I'm going to be able to do? Can I provide for my family, you know, long-term? Is there long-term viability to working in ag? He gave me one bit of advice. He said, if you can budget like Ken Jones, you're going to be just fine. And I would say that's probably where most of us get tripped up, is that budget. It's simple, you know, I mean, spend within your means. Don't get out in front of yourself. Realize that interest sleeps day and night. Doesn't sleep day or night. It just keeps on accruing, and it can work for you just as easily as it can work against you. So now about my take on subsidies, I guess I'll just attack it from a personal standpoint, which I need to say, because I was just, my expenses were just covered so I could travel back to Washington, D.C. to represent the Nevada Cattlemen's Association. So these are my feelings. The Cattlemen's Association, one of their big, sponsors. Anyway, somebody that gives them a lot of money is WSR, I think. I can't remember what their initials are, but they sell crop insurance, drought insurance. That's what they do. So I'm not representing the Cattlemen's Association. I'm representing myself here. But,
right.
I have a hard problem with it for the, I have a hard time with it for the following reason. It's kind of taken free market out of it quite a bit, because where we don't participate in any program, none of them, we have to go out and compete against those that do. And so we're at a disadvantage there. Second thing is we have to pay back the taxes. And then obviously the third one is we didn't take it in the first place. So we're standing up there at bat, I like to say. We're at the plate waiting for the pitch, and we already got three strikes against us. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be hard to continue to compete that way.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I could also clarify my statements by saying that, honestly, I'm kind of sitting on the fence here wondering if we're going to be able to continue to be viable where we are already three strikes behind everyone else that we're competing against.
Yeah, appreciate that. And I think there's a lot of people that are in that same boat. You know, we're experiencing record high commodity prices right now on the beef side, on the cattle side, but yet still there's a lot of ranchers in the circles that I run in, specifically through Doug Ferguson, who teaches sell by marketing, who says he gets regular calls of people who can't get refinanced. You know, their lines of credit are not, their whatever ratios are out of whack, and they and this is with $1,600 calves or whatever they're bringing. So feel the pain and appreciate that. Cade, what are your thoughts about it? And kind of want to get your thoughts, maybe to lead off, if you're willing to share, maybe from a founding father standpoint, you know, were subsidies a part of the original Constitution as it was written? And kind of what are your thoughts from that standpoint, and then bring it home to where you're at today?
Sure, Jared. First, you're too kind, and I don't see myself in the way you explain me. I believe in the Constitution. I have read some documents. It would probably be more accurate.
Okay.
So I'm not an authority at all. But certainly, my opinion is just like has been shared. I agree wholeheartedly with what Gary and is Gary, right? Gary and
yes.
Marlo have just shared. So I don't want to be redundant there. I feel the same way. I think from my understanding of the founding fathers and the Constitution, no, it wasn't a part of, I mean, government subsidies as in regards to the Farm Bill, et cetera, wasn't a part of that. Some might argue that they did believe in a public education system by way of universities being set up to teach, you know, and you know, some of the state universities. So that may be considered. You know, maybe there is some level of subsidy granted in that regard to kind of produce in a general fashion, or make sure that people are increasing education and that the best technology is being produced. And if anybody wants to disagree with that, feel free, you know, on this call. But those are some things that I've come across lately that surprised me a little bit. But so I think from that angle too, one thing I think we've all got to kind of admit is if that is true, what that statement I just put forth there, and if they truly did feel that way, then it's hard to extricate ourselves from subsidy in every single fashion. We're all maybe subsidized in some way, shape, or form, right? I think it's good to recognize that. As far as subsidies helping individual farmers or ranchers, I think personally they weren't for that. I think as we recognize the whole purpose of the government was to protect our life, liberty, and our pursuit of happiness, not necessarily prop any one person up or any one corporation or any portion of life. You know, it was just equal opportunity, not equal things. And that equal opportunity to live and to go to work and produce and use the ingenuity that you have to create a profit. You know, that was what the government's initial purpose was. And since it has grown, right, and it's changed and et cetera. And I think from my personal opinion, they have overstepped the bounds there in regards to what the original founders' ideas were. I guess there's an ethical side of it too. It's kind of like, you know, Marlo kind of talked a little bit about his grandfather with the Social Security checks, and there is so many different ideas out there. And I just, if it's all right right now, just share about some ethical questions regarding subsidies. Is that all right, Jared?
Yeah, please.
At this point. So I think one of the things that interests me a little bit is as I go around and talk to, you know, the guys that I associate with, there's guys that some take subsidies, some don't, you know, and all of them, I would say, are really good men. I have high regards for all of them. But one of the things that ethically, that it's always an interest to me is many of us, we all kind of are friends of freedom, so to speak, and conservative, believe ourselves to be on the sides of the original, the original revolution, if you will, the patriots, and so to speak. And so on one hand, we, you know, kind of opposed to socialistic programs, kind of opposed to government handouts, et cetera, in regards to the welfare program. And then on the other hand, they're willing to accept subsidies. And for me, that I'm not, you know, it's not casting judgment, but the question comes in my mind is that a form of hypocrisy? And what do we do with that? You know, as I've looked into some of the stats there, it says a lot of times these ag subsidies, the recipients of that are receiving four times more than the average individual is that's on the government dole in regards to welfare. And how do we answer that if we truly are feeling like we are friends of the Republic, so to speak, in that original document, the original document that was set forth? That's kind of an interesting thing. The other thing that I think would be kind of ethical to answer the ethical side of the question is, so back under Eisenhower, his Secretary of Agriculture was Edward F. Benson.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that he put forth that I thought was a really interesting question was this. He says, essentially, would people feel the same about their government subsidy if the government wrote them a letter and says, you are still entitled to the money that you are due, but in order to get it, you're going to have to go and collect it yourself. And here's the list of your neighbors. And this is how much each one owes. So you can take this letter, you can go door to door and ask them to write you a check for that money. Would that change how we felt about a government subsidy? And I thought that was a really good example to kind of work through whether we take it or not. You know, even if your business is failing, would you still feel like, going back to some of the arguments for subsidies, they always say it's a national security issue, et cetera, stuff like that. Is it enough of a national security issue that you would feel comfortable going to your next door neighbor and collecting the $50 from them and then going up the street 2 miles and collecting $100 from that individual, from 50 cents from the old lady down the corner? You know, if it is enough of a national crisis, or not, I mean, a national security issue, that you feel like if I'm not in production, the whole world goes apart, that, yeah, I think I would go and get that, then maybe it's okay to take it. If your answer to those questions is, no, I'd be too embarrassed, then maybe ethically we shouldn't be accepting these subsidies. Maybe they're not exactly what they are being claimed to be. Just a thought of kind of a litmus test to how we feel about it. I certainly believe that subsidies inevitably, in a lot of ways, props up inefficiency. As has been said, you know, if you know you're just going to get the check, why do you try to change things? Why do you try to cut costs in different areas or reinvent how the ranch is running? Like one of them, whoever said that, their dad said, the ranch, something has taken place that has transcended the inefficiency. You were just getting a free handout.
Thanks, so, Gabe. Well said.
Yep.
Well said. William, let's get your take. And then if you wouldn't mind, maybe weave in a little bit of what cheap food costs, really. Like a lot of people say, well, you know, we've got to subsidize this so we can have cheap food. And if you're willing to kind of tackle that and your thoughts as well.
Yeah, for sure. So I'm just going to start with the cheap food. Cheap food means high medical costs. That's the reality. That's what it translates into. If you want cheap food, you're going to be insulin resistant. You're going to end up with type 2 diabetes. You're going to end up with all the autoimmune diseases. Not one person will get them all, hopefully, but in your community, and how many of us right now know somebody with diabetes? Probably most of the people we know are dealing with these issues. I mean, there's little kids nowadays who are struggling with all this stuff, and it all comes from cheap food. So, man, I could go off on that, but I'm just going to leave it at that right now. And the thing is, when we look at these subsidies, I think one of the big problems is our understanding of what they are and what they do. And we're trained in our modern educational system to be the same. Everybody sell your cattle at the sale barn. Everybody sell your corn at the elevator. Everybody sell your vegetables at the farmer's market. If you're a big vegetable farmer, then you're selling it to the Sysco truck. By the way, the Sysco truck will come to your farm and pick it up if you have enough that makes it worth it. So we're trained to do everything the same. And then if you have a problem, well, the government subsidies are there to make sure that we have a food supply. And so it will help to keep you going. These are the main things that I learned when I went to college and in the ag college. So I learned very little about what does my community need and what can I do with my gifts and talents to serve my community. I didn't really hear that. Nobody talked about that at college. And then you talk to all the people who graduate from college and they're going out there and they're doing their ag businesses. They're doing it the way they learned at college because they paid $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 for their degree. And that's a big investment. And so we better do what they said because it cost us a lot of money. We assume that they were right in what they told us. And then there's this crazy neighbor down the valley or whatever, and they're making a seven-figure income on their organic vegetable patch. And we're scratching our heads saying, well, we can barely make it, and we're getting this government subsidy every year. And here they are, a millionaire, selling their broccoli all over the United States. And in the ag community, we tend to look down on those people, except they're the ones who figured it out financially because they're giving the community the product that the community wanted. So the entrepreneurial aspect of this is really what's being left out. The sad thing about the subsidies, if we're dependent on that subsidy because the sale barn doesn't give us enough or the elevator isn't giving us enough and there's too much government red tape, if we're blaming all that stuff, then it's killing our own ingenuity to be an entrepreneur, to go out there and, you know, and to build a business that the customer actually wants. So it's really, I don't see it as a problem of a government subsidy. I think the problem is a lack of proper education and a lack of human creativity and human ingenuity to just get out there and use your gifts and talents in the agriculture world to do something that the community wants. Now, you know, if we're raising cattle on a ranch, we think, well, everybody in my community raises their own beef. That's not really what I'm talking about. I mean, if that is true, then just spread your horizon of what the community is. Because for every rancher who thinks that, well, everybody raises their own beef, there's another rancher out there making good money. He's profitable, and he's passing on his ranch to his kids, and they have a thriving business because they used their creativity and their ingenuity to make their business into a wealthy situation. So those are my two cents.
Perfect. Yeah, appreciate that. Appreciate that, William. Okay, other thoughts? Maybe a question, whoever wants to tackle it. Are there any hidden threats to participating in the subsidy program?
I wouldn't know. You know, I don't have an answer for that one just because we never have. I would say, you know, kind of what's been said already, I guess. Let's go back to the CFAP money during the coronavirus deal. There's a lot of my neighbors that participated in that, you know. We market our calves a little bit differently in that we don't sell them off of the mother. We send them to a feedlot. Well, we typically market in late February, January, February. That's when we market. COVID kind of hit during that period. So we had all of our calves, 850 calves or something like that. And now there was no market for them as soon as COVID hit. That could have, well, it was a huge impact to our business. Well, the government came in and said, hey, that's a huge deal. You know, that you guys, that's onerous. We'll pay you this much for, what was it? I can't remember. They're going to pay you so much money per head of animal that you had. That could have been high six-figure number that they would have given us. But we didn't do that. We just weathered it. We decided instead of selling those calves at a huge, huge discount, we just feed them ourselves and sent them to a feedlot, fed them out, and then sold them on the grid. We believe in our cows and our calves, and sold them on the grid. And we didn't make a whole lot of money on it, but we didn't lose any. Mm-hmm. And we didn't take a dime from the CFAP money. Where we had neighbors they'd already sold their calves. They had sold their coal cows. The market decline after COVID didn't affect them at all. But they were able to receive, you know, maybe five digit numbers. And I don't know, that one is a hard one for me, because then we went out and bought bulls later that year. And we're showing up, you know, thinking that we're going to need to pinch some pennies and find some bargains. And we have people showing up in brand new pickups and prices for bulls were just sky high. Well, that's because they weren't spending their own money. So that made it very difficult. But you know, that's, like I said, so we weathered that one. This last winter, we had cows die out on our winter range. Government says that's onerous. You know, we're going to go ahead and give you money for those dead calves, dead cows. And that would have been six figures probably to our bottom line. And I was sorely tempted because I thought we were going to have to go out and buy heifers in order to, you know, make sure we had calves. And Ken said, no, let's just build slow. We'll just do it the way we've done it. And, you know, we're almost two years past that, I guess 18 months past that. We're doing all right. Just build slow, be patient. And I think that might be part of what, you know, that instant gratification. Now there is another side to that token. I do believe there is a place for it. And I think Kate was kind of alluding to it. The best way I could liken it is the tornadoes that go through the Midwest, tears out somebody's house. And that guy can't, you know, he's got no house now, and he still has a mortgage payment to make, and the bank needs its money. Anyway, there's a lot of layers there of problems due to a natural disaster like that. And so is there a place for it? Yeah, I think so. I think that that needs to be reconciled at some level. But maybe not the guy that's already got his house paid off and it's insured. You know, maybe that guy's going to be all right. Anyway, so I'm not smart enough to know what the answer is. I just know that there is a way to survive in this business if you're willing to be patient, frugal, and innovative, like William's kind of alluding to. And but it doesn't hurt. I'm not going to sit here and tell you that I built all this by myself. It surely doesn't help or hurt to be able to be in a position, because it's a generational ranch, with a lot of people that have the same beliefs and practices that help you be sustainable, I guess, over generations. If I was a brand new guy that had just gone out and bought a whole bunch of cows on debt, and then had a winter like we did in 22, and now the bank's wanting its money, and I don't even have any cows to show for it, that would be a different conversation.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, it's good that we can see both sides for sure. What are your thoughts, Gary?
I think to some extent, maybe a large extent, I think a lot of these subsidies and payments and whatever you want to call them propagate dishonesty. To somebody that you may know and you trust him day in and day out, but that carrot hanging out there, I think it breeds dishonesty in a lot of people. And I don't know. I guess I'll go back to if it's not working, change. But they don't have to change because they get the money coming in. So, like Marlon says, they go buy their brand new pickups and whatever, the brand new tractor and whatnot. And we don't buy brand new anything, pickup, tractor, car, whatever. And we have a saying around our table. If we're discussing buying something, then the subject is this a want or a need? And if it's
There you
just a
go.
want, it's probably not going to go. If it's a need, then we figure out a way to make it work. And maybe we can't make it work right away like we'd like to.
Yeah.
But I would like people to understand that there is a way to get out from under all that if you really want to. Maybe a lot of people don't really want to because it's easy.
Yeah,
But
that's.
at this point in time, I'll give you another little story. My father always, he had a $100,000 operating loan every year. And I was asking him, well, why do you do that? Well, that's the way I've always done it. And I says, well, why don't we quit doing it? And he just didn't want to do that, but he finally let me work out it, and we got to a point we don't take out an operating loan.
Huh, cool.
We don't take out a loan, period. It would have to be an awfully huge expense before we would take out a loan. We've worked ourselves in a position where we've got money set aside. If we needed a pickup or we need a tractor, we take that money and we actually pay interest on it. So we loan ourselves the money and pay it back. And I don't know, it took us a long time, and it really wasn't, it's not that hard to do if people would just knuckle down and do it. But with these subsidies out there, people aren't going to do it. They won't
I
change.
had a friend. He was trying to get me to sign up for drought insurance. You know, we got a pretty sizable winter allotment, lots of acres, and it's always in a state of drought. Anyway, we could have been making money. Anyway, he was trying to sell me on it. And I loved the term that he used to sell me on it. He says, it's not much, but they're pennies from heaven. And I thought, well, they're not really pennies from heaven. It's kind of what Kate was saying. They're pennies from you and me. And
Yeah, it's free money. You might as well take it. It's free money.
Yeah,
and you've already paid for it because you've been paying your taxes this whole time. There's lots of ways to justify it, right?
Yeah.
And the next guy, if you go broke, the next guy's not even going to care about all the stewardship and things that you've done. So you're not being a good steward by not partaking this. I've heard that argument recently as well, because you know, you might go broke, and then what's going to happen to all that you've done? So lots of ways to justify it. So kind of Cade, one, I'll throw out a couple statistics here. These aren't made up. This is from the Cato Institute, and I'll put this in the show notes also, but let's see, that one study found that 60% of subsidies from three large programs, crop insurance, ARC, PLC, whatever those acronyms are, go to the largest 10% of farms. The study also found that large farms were more intensely subsidized than small farms. For crop insurance program, for example, the largest 10% of farms received an average of $29 per acre compared to the average of $12 per acre on all other farms. So what are your thoughts on that? I mean, what if subsidies were a good thing, wouldn't it be better to support the smaller scale farmers, ranchers, rather than those? I mean, should somebody look at their profit and loss and see if they warrant it before they just automatically qualify? What are your thoughts, Cade?
Well, I don't know, Jared. All I could really share is speculation on that. So if someone has a actual factual position, they ought to speak up.
Okay. Anybody else want to tackle that from the standpoint of, I guess that's one of the challenges that I see with the program, is that it's in the taxpayer's mind. I would have to believe that they think that this is supporting the family farm, the family ranch, the farm bill, when in reality, a small portion of that goes to the family farmer. A bigger portion goes to those who have the dollars to lobby for the money. And so whether that be packing plants, large corporate farms and ranches, internationally owned corporations. So I do have a challenge with that, if anybody wants to chime in.
Yeah, I'll say something about that. From time to time, we do have legislation that people vote on that have to do with the farm bill. And anytime that happens, it's very interesting to see the way that that it's advertised. And they always say, save the American family farm. And they show the picture of a dad and a mom holding a couple of kids in front of their tractor in the cornfield. Those aren't the people that get it. I mean, they get a little bit, but it's the big corporations who get the money. The big people, they have the full-time employees, and their job is to just go get all the money you can get from the government, figure it out, and that's their job. So when the public vote on this type of thing, the perception of what we're voting for is not, I mean, it's just not the reality of like where the money goes. I mean, I've been watching that for 30 years, and it's, you know, it's interesting when those things come up. And most people don't even know they're voting for the farm bill, because modern people, we don't read fine print of government documents anymore as a society. But anyway, that's all I have to say about that.
I know quite a few years ago, and they've kind of changed things up now, it seems like, where it's, I suppose there's some way to find it, but I used to look up who was getting what. You could go to the website, and you could just write down to your neighbor or whoever. So just fooling around one night, I was looking at places in Texas, and there was a mortgage company that does what I don't know what they're all involved in. And they got, it was either $12 or $14 million. Some mortgage company. And how they swing that, I don't know. So I think there's probably a lot of that goes on. I know Simplot got a huge paycheck through the COVID stuff.
Yeah. And so, I mean, certainly I'm not against big business corporations, but first and foremost, I'm for a free market economy. And so what do these do to distort the economy? And particularly, I mean, how does that trickle down? And maybe how are we actually paying for that free money? You kind of alluded to that, Marlo, but.
Yeah, you don't have to look very far to see that. Look at any listing lately that's going to say, you know, runs 900 cows, so many deeded acres, so much access to public AUMs, received so much money from drought insurance. I mean, it's right now, it's on the listing, how much money you're going to receive because of drought insurance on some of these listings in Arizona, I know specifically, and I'm sure nationwide.
Yeah.
And so, you know, now it's getting fixed into your buy-in cost. And, you know, so, I mean, that's inflating the price of what the ranch can produce, not so much what you can get from the government. You just don't have to look very far to see what it's doing to the free market part of it. And I, you know, I don't know if we want to go down the road of public grazing, but that's the one that's kind of hard because the term welfare rancher gets thrown out there so loose.
Oh, yeah.
We could be classified as welfare ranchers because we pay an AUM that's maybe not indicative of what somebody's paying on private lands. It's so misunderstood on how much money an AUM costs. I mean, yeah, it's $1.85 or whatever. Well, we spend a lot more than that per cow on our desert operation. And you know, we have to make sure that we keep it into a number that we can afford to pay. And so, you know, I was having another conversation with somebody that's not in agriculture. He day works, I guess. So maybe because he's in agriculture, but he says, yeah, ranchers are the biggest welfare recipients in the entire nation. And he probably isn't wrong. But those of us that are trying to make a living on public ground grazing, I'm not sure that we quite qualify as a welfare rancher when we're spending a lot of money to maintain things out there and equip things. And anyway, yeah, so the pasture lease, I guess you could call it, maybe isn't what it would be on private ground, but there's a lot of money that goes into that AUM.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. Good point. I appreciate that. I've wondered that as well. And, you know, I told this story before. We had a extensive BLM allotment, and due to wild horse issues, things beyond our control, it was sold. And so hindsight, we could be very profitable had we kept that and qualified for drought insurance and never turned a cow out. And who cares what happens to the range and the horses? It kind of went against our personal integrity, and it's not even something that we even knew about at the time, and grateful I wasn't faced with that temptation, honestly. But Cade,
just going back to your question on how subsidies can distort the market. And I think you pretty well alluded to it when you were talking about these big corporations receiving all those, that big money, and they can pay more for land. And, you know, even without the insurance or whatever that's coming with it, that's tacked on the ranch and the listing, but they can pay more than that ranch can viably produce just off the land. And so you can't really compete with them if you're not in that same ballpark, right? And so the more these big business people are pulling from the government, I mean, it's just, even if you are taking subsidies as a small farmer, you're never going to be able to compete with those kind of entities that are being set up because of all this additional money they're gleaning from the government. You know, I think that's where the term crony capitalism comes from, doesn't it? You know, you start seeing these big corporations kind of you know, they can begin to lobby and then they get favors, all that stuff, you know. I think that's a big place that we see some of that distortion. And then that trickles down just to just the whole thing Marlo had mentioned about those subsidies and people showing up with brand new pickups, you know, that also, there is a competition factor, no question. Especially when you're just trying to buy a little chunk of land that fits your operation, but you can't compete for it, you know? So.
Yeah. Yeah. I appreciate that. Appreciate your input there. So again, from this article from the Cato Institute, they quote, different countries do not have subsidies such as New Zealand. And so it makes me wonder, you know, speculate, I guess, a little bit. And this is purely speculation here, but let's say that under the next president, and somehow he convinces Congress and they just say, no more, we're done, we've got to cut something, it's going to be subsidies, it's going to be that part of the farm bill. What would happen?
I think I'd go out and buy some more land. Honestly, I think, you know, that you've heard the term too big to fail. What makes something too big to fail? I think that we all believe here that these subsidies, these programs, they perpetuate inefficiencies. And so, you know, if you can't operate, if you're inefficient, you're going to fail. But that's okay. Failure's okay, because somebody else more innovative, more creative, more ambitious can buy up the postal service and make something awesome out of all of the assets that they have. Yeah. You know, that's an easy one to poke a hole at, because the postal service is highly subsidized. You know, let a private company come in here and buy that place, and boy, with the assets that it has and with the maybe the brand that it has, you could really, really do something with that. Somebody could. So yeah, I guess what I would do is wait for those inefficient and maybe less ambitious operators. Maybe I have an opportunity to expand a little bit.
Yeah. Good thought. William?
You know, I have no idea what would happen if the subsidies went away tomorrow, but I would certainly hope that a lot of these people, young people in their 20s who want to get into agriculture, that it would give them an opportunity to show the older people who are addicted to the subsidies how it's done. I mean, you know, I mean, I'm in education. I'm working with young people a lot. There are thousands and thousands of people in their 20s right now. They're out of school, and their dream is to have a farm to produce a superior product for their community. And they can't get land because it's all too expensive. And yet, many of them are making it happen anyway. They're finding weird pieces of land to lease. You know, just they're making it happen, even though it seems impossible to the masses. And with that kind of tenacity, I think that if the farm subsidies went away, it would be a fantastic opportunity for a lot of these people to just to come in and do something just awesome, you know. So that's my take on it.
Yeah, you don't think we'd all starve? What do you think, Cade?
No, I don't think we'd all starve. I think, like you say, there's human ingenuity is amazing. Yeah. You know, and especially when it's crunch time, it's unreal what people come up with. So no, I don't think we'd starve. And I think, like you mentioned New Zealand, and I recognize that we are not the same, you know, the dynamics, demographics, everything. We are different countries, but you hate to say that it would go the exactly same way. But you look at what happened in New Zealand, and that's exactly what you're talking about. 1984, they couldn't afford it, and they cut it. Farm subsidies went away. They were highly subsidized up at that point. And then it stopped cold turkey. And I read an article about a guy that was farming during that time, and it pushed him out of business. He couldn't make it, but a lot of people did. And he mentioned, he says, you know what really hurt? He says, that wasn't easy. but he said it was the best thing that ever happened in New Zealand. And just the dairy side of it, there was one stat that brought up that was like before the subsidy were taken away, there were like 44 milk products available. After the subsidy went away, it went jumped over 2,000. And so people just, they thought about things. They came up with things. They, you know, and so, like I say, we're different countries. It may not happen the same way, but I would tend to believe in people. And yeah, I believe in human ingenuity. It's amazing.
Thanks, Cade. Yep. So not to be all doom and gloom here, what do we do about it? I mean, what, I'd just like to get the thought from everybody. What is a, Gary, you've alluded to it. Anything else to add? And then we'll just go around the room and we'll just invite the off the wall ideas it might be. So, you know, I do, when we look at our clients' numbers, when we look at that bottom line, the subsidies come in after that. If they're not profitable before that, they don't really have a they don't have a regenerative business, right? We all talk about land regeneration, but if we're not profitable, we can't regenerate the land. We can't be good stewards long term. And so we encourage them to look for ways that they can wean themselves off of it. But so that's my thought. What do you guys think? What's the positive side of it? Or what's the steps to take?
I don't know that I have much of an answer for that. You've somehow, and I don't know how you do it because I've talked to quite a few people, you need to change their mindset. You need to change their way of looking at things. And maybe I'm not very good at it because I'm pretty to the point and blunt and whatnot. But I probably, if anything, maybe turn people off a little bit. But I don't see the answer. They've got to change their mindset before they're going to change their operation. And even if they do change their operation, are they still going to want their subsidies? You know, I don't know.
So it starts
there.
It starts in this space between our left and our right ear.
Yes.
And changing that mindset. And sometimes it takes a generation die off for things to change. It seems like the trajectory is going the wrong direction. Like we are in fostering more entitlement instead of less. So, and we know that cycles of history repeat themselves. And, you know, will we see another depression? Likely. What will that look like? We don't know. But so, okay. What else do you guys think? What do we do?
I'll go ahead and chime in here. I think we need to inspire people to greatness. I mean, why are people taking the subsidies anyway? Because it's money you can buy something with. Well, what if you could use your creativity to do something to make millions and millions of dollars? You're never going to get that much money from a subsidy. So let's teach the young people how to be entrepreneurs. Let's give them some real training. Let's give them some good education. And not the mainstream education. Let's give them some entrepreneurial education. Let's go study the 50 richest people in the world. How did they do it? And not corrupt riches, but the good, honest people who became wealthy, doing something good to actually help the world and make the world a better place. And, you know, that's what I try to do with the students that I work with. So I think that's the answer. Forget the subsidies. Let's get 10 times richer than any subsidy can make us.
Amen.
I think there's a lot of truth to what you're saying there, because I think in a lot of respects, the subsidies hold people back. And they don't see that. But I think it really truly does. I think it holds them down.
Well, I'm gonna ride on Ken's coattails on this answer a little bit too. My 84-year-old father-in-law, who was born right after the Great Depression. His big complaint is, who cares? Who cares about our country? And I think if we could get people maybe to care, some of the people that I know that are participating didn't participate before. And they just, you know, they just kind of decided, I guess, in order to fight it, I'm just going to join it. But my father-in-law's words were, you know, he says, I don't care if our country gets driven into the ground, but I'm not going to be the one that's hammering the nail. And so that's, you know, that's a pretty lone mentality. There's not very many like that. And I think he came to that conclusion, you know, by watching these ancestors do it, but also because he saw discomfort. He witnessed it. I think there's going to have to be some discomfort before anything changes. Personally, my only hope, Jared, the only thing I hope for, and I've even asked for it, you know, I alluded that I went back to Washington, D.C. I talked to somebody that is in those committee meetings, and I said, hey, I understand that there's billions being spent here, but what about those of us that aren't participating and taking the billions? Is there any tax relief at all that we can appeal to? And he said, no, there's not. That's not going to happen. That's the only hope that I have, is that, okay, so if is there an avenue in which, if I don't participate, at least don't make me pay for those that do. But again, I mean, that's a pie in the sky idea. It's just a pipe dream and a hope. But if I didn't have to pay for everybody else's subsidies, I'd be content.
Okay. Yeah. Good thought. What do you think, Cade? What's the action steps that the average farmer rancher can take?
I said I love what's been said, and I think the only thing I would add is this: we got one life to live, you know. And I love what Marlo's father-in-law said. You know, it might go in the ground, but he's not going to be the one driving in the nail. And that's what this is about. I think, like you said, it's if you listen to what Gary's saying and Marlo and Jared and William, this is an ethical question that each of us has pondered in our lives, and we are acting because of that ethic. It's like you said, we thought about it and had these considerations in our mind. We may not change the course of the nation, but we will change the course of our lives. And at the end of our lives, who do we want to be? If ethically we decide that this is wrong, nothing else matters. The loss of a business, the loss of anything, what, who cares? You stayed the course, and you were a hero in regards to that thing, right? The pressures of the world didn't break you. And what else matters? You died with integrity. Man, that's a whole lot better than dying with a million in the bank, isn't it? If it's an ethical question, and your decision is it is wrong, and I wouldn't go to my neighbor and take the money directly from them, start there, change. And then from that point on, follow William's direction. Use your mind, be excited about life, and figure another way to make your millions. So that's my two cents.
I like it. I like it. Well, it's been great to have this conversation with you guys. And, you know, we've been rolling here for about an hour, and we'll probably just wrap it up with some final comments from everybody and then bring it into a conclusion. But I think we can see both sides, like from what Marlo said. Definitely, you know, that we'll call it a temptation, I guess, is there. A temptation, because I do believe that it is against my ethical beliefs at this point. And so there's lots of ways you can justify it. And by no means are you an unethical person if you do, or are you a bad person if you do, or, you know, that you don't deserve to be in business. We just wanted to bring another side to the story. And I appreciate these men who've been brave enough to be on here, who are going to go out and face their neighbors. And some of them may listen to this or watch the recording. But maybe it'll open up some room for discussion and for questioning within our family meetings, within our businesses. We're probably not going to change the large corporations who have lobbyists. But what can we change? Where can we have an influence? And that's over, like what Cade said, those individuals' decisions that we have. Are we living in integrity with our values and with what we hold near and dear? And if we fail, can we still recognize that we as individuals are not failures? If our net worth goes down, it doesn't have to drag our self-worth with it, right? We may not know all the answers, and we're certainly not proclaiming that anyone in this room does. But if we don't face those hard decisions, maybe we will never know what our potential truly is. And so we hope that this is opened your eyes a little bit. And so let's just go around the room and let's go William, Marlowe, Cade, and then wrap up with Gary. William, Marlowe, Cade, and Gary in that order. Just your final thoughts.
All right. Thank you, Jared. My final thoughts is be brave, be strong, do what you were born to do. And if you don't know what you were born to do, figure it out. You know, what are your gifts? What are your talents? What are your interests? What are your passions? And when you can honestly answer those questions, that leads you to your life's work. And then go out and do it. Find somebody to love. Find a need in society that needs to be fulfilled and go fulfill it. We certainly, this world certainly needs a lot of help in the food, you know. We need a lot more food. So people in agriculture, we need more people and we need higher quality food. So sky's the limit. The opportunities are there.
William is very, very inspirational. Thank you very much. You know, it doesn't surprise me a bit that the five of us didn't find an answer to this question. That's it's a hard question. And I guess I've kind of hinted at where I feel the answer is. And I hinted at it backwards, I guess. I don't know if anybody's picked up on it, but Ken's father sent Social Security checks back. My father-in-law, you know, he's teaching me, don't be the guy that drives the death nail in. Well, the opposite is true too. If you're taking that subsidy and your kids are watching you, it's going to be a lot easier for them to take it. And so I guess that's my advice there is those of us that have a sphere of influence and maybe the next generation, make sure that they're watching you do it the right way. And the right way is to try to do it by yourself. Maybe I shouldn't say by yourself because it takes a community, but
yeah,
there's value in standing on your own 2 feet, you know, and trying to provide for you and for those that depend on you without any additional financial help. And if your kids watch you do that, maybe you give up a subsidy. Maybe you're the generation that decides to not live on an operating loan. The next generation will see it and build on that positive momentum.
Like it. Cade.
Yeah, I appreciate what William and Marlowe have said and what Gary will say. Yeah. I think it just goes back for me is I think that it's, we need to take the time to read just a few things, study it out. I mean, if people are watching this, they've obviously had some thoughts regarding subsidy, I would think. And I would suggest one thing is Proper Role of Government by Ezra Taft Benson. That was a great read in regards to a lot of things, but specifically in subsidies, there's a lot on that. And it'll just at least lead you down that road of the ethical side of the question. And then, and then live your life, be happy, do what you love and recognize that, man, who we are more matters so much more than anything else. And who we become matters more to what our future generations become. I love what you just said, Marlo. I mean, live what you believe, but study it out in your mind and figure out what the right course is.
Perfect. Thanks, Gary.
I don't know that I really have much more to add. You guys have pretty well covered it and done an excellent job, I think. And I appreciate all you guys. And it's kind of refreshing to know that you're not the only one out there. Because that's really about all I got. You guys did a very good job.
Well, as
some food you for did thought.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And we're not alone, you know, in the regenerative agriculture industry, everybody knows Gabe Brown. And I actually reached out to him. I think he's actually traveling internationally right now. Otherwise, I think he would be on and maybe we'll get him on at a future date. But he talks about his journey of weaning himself off subsidies and away from debt and has been highly successful after some pretty tough years. And so, guys and gals, it's been wonderful to spend this time with you. We do these webinars. Generally, we do it live with an audience. We actually have one tomorrow night, which whenever you view this recording, it will be in the past, with Dallas Mont from Ranching for Profit. I encourage you to check out the Profitable Steward podcast, but also go to the YouTube page, The Profitable Ag Steward. That's where you can see our bright smiling faces, and also most of the presenters do a presentation style, so you can get more of the picture that way. The Profitable Ag Steward is the YouTube, and we'll put the link in the show notes. So this will be coming out on there. We've got a playlist specifically of podcasts, it's called. So we just wrapped up. We did a virtual summit, which will be coming out on that channel as those individual speakers come out. That was last month. And so just look for upcoming events, and we hope you'll continue to join us for these things. Continue the education process. Continue to improve upon your stewardships. And we hope that we can help you along that journey. And again, thanks to these men, Kate Davis, Gary Wines, Marla Dahl, William DeMille, for joining us here today. Appreciate you, your vulnerability. This one, I wonder, you know, a couple of weeks ago we talked about addiction, depression, and suicide in ag. I don't know if this isn't more vulnerable, you guys, than that one. That one was pretty raw and pretty real, but this one I think was equally so. And so we want to bring some perspectives to it that maybe we haven't seen, and hopefully make sure that your business lasts for generations to come. And if we can be a part of that, it's an honor. So thanks for joining, and we hope to catch you on another one.
Thanks for joining us on the Profitable Steward podcast. Want to learn more about making your enterprise more profitable? Check out Ag Steward on our website, www.agsteward.fyi. Here at Ag Steward, we're working hard to make sure you have the latest tools and knowledge from the field of regenerative agriculture. Subscribe to our podcast to keep up with the latest info, and help us spread the word by giving this video a thumbs up, sharing this information with other farmers, and as always, please join the conversation by leaving us a rating and a review so we can help you to keep growing strong.